This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The Chinese Communist Party turns 100 with a 21st century message for the rest of the world.
And now the party is willing to say, we are more benevolent than these so-called democracies of countries like America, because we actually deliver.
Also today, Turkey walks away from a European convention that protects women from abusive relationships. Turkish feminists say the treaty empowered women.
They find the courage in themselves so they can just divorce their husbands.
I'm Marco Werman, and trying to beat the heat while living in the right neighborhood is a matter of life or death.
You are more likely to die during extreme heat if you live in a hot part of town.
We also look at the long-term vision in one Indian city to cool things down. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you today.
Ming Li Pao.
A 100-cannon salute in Beijing today to mark a century of China's Communist Party. President Xi Jinping also gave a rousing speech to an overflowing crowd. We start our coverage today with The Economist David Rennie, who had a front-row seat to the festivities.
China's Communist Party threw itself a 100th birthday party, and they did that in Tiananmen Square, which is the ceremonial heart of China. The crowd was handpicked. They were almost all party members. I was sitting next to some members of the People's Congress for the city of Beijing. There was a lot of singing of Communist Party songs, and everyone around me knew all of the words to those, you know, greatest hits like, you know, without the Communist Party, there would be no China. So it was this mix of the very grand and formal and the kind of national, but also this strange feeling of a kind of private family gathering of a party celebrating in the open its absolute control of this giant country. So the main event was a speech by Xi Jinping, who we refer to as President Xi, but whose most important job is as General Secretary of the Communist Party. And he spoke from the rostrum, from the terrace of the Tiananmen Gate, the front of the Forbidden City, where Mao declared the forming of the People's Republic in 1949, the setting for all great party and state events. And he wore a Mao suit, where all the former leaders around him wore suits and ties, to make that point that he is the kind of the heir to a long tradition going back to the founding of the People's Republic more than 70 years ago. It was a very carefully crafted, revealing speech. It lasted more than an hour. And in a way, it was a mixture of the old and the new. So there were things in the speech that many other communist leaders have said in the past about how China used to be humiliated by Britain and France and other colonial powers, how they grabbed territory like Hong Kong, and that the Communist Party had helped China regain its pride and its sovereignty and its full control of its own territory. That you would have heard from any number of speakers in the past. But two big things have changed which were new about the Xi era. One is how the party presents itself within China, much more willing to admit that senior officials are party members, that their most important jobs are often their party jobs. Xi is much more willing to talk about the party being in charge. Then the international context has changed. There is a much greater sense of confidence now that the Communist Party is not just the best form of government for a poor, not very well-educated country like China, which is what you used to hear two decades ago. Now they're willing to say, look at how well we have handled COVID. Look at how well our economy has fared for the last 40 years. Look at the chaos and the partisan paralysis in the West, especially in America. And now the party is willing to say, we are more benevolent than these so-called democracies of countries like America, because we actually deliver for our people in a way that these squabbling, corrupt, incompetent politicians who run Western countries cannot match. Interestingly, and perhaps worryingly, the most enthusiastic applause, the loudest cheers, were for the most nationalist line. It was a line where Xi Jinping talked about foreign countries had bullied China in the past, and he pledged that if they were to do so again, they would dash their heads against a great wall of steel made of the flesh and blood of 1.4 billion Chinese people.
President Xi Jinping addressing a crowd in Tiananmen Square, with comments there from The Economist's Beijing bureau chief David Rennie. Thanks to our partners at Economist Radio for sharing that with us. President Xi certainly remains popular in China, and so does his party. Joining us now to look at the evolution of the Chinese Communist Party are two people born in China in somewhat different eras. Yangyang Cheng is a physicist, a fellow at Yale Law School, and a columnist at SubChina. Xiao Chang is the editor of China Digital Times. He also teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and directs the school's Counterpower Lab. Let me start with what we just heard, that fiery rhetoric from President Xi of heads bashed, bloody against a great wall of steel. Does that grab the public imagination and stir pride for many Chinese? Yangyang.
Yeah, I think that's a line that can resonate with a lot of Chinese people. And it's something that I do worry about because, well, the Chinese people are people. Their sense of love and pride for their country is genuine. On the other hand, as people, their emotions can be manipulated and they are susceptible to rhetoric. And what we are seeing now with China's new superpower status, it is that it is increasingly displaying this hardened edge where national strength is interpreted as this unabashed, cynical power of force.
Xiaocheng, does that kind of rhetoric worry you and why?
Well, I was born in 1960s and I've been grew up through the Cultural Revolution. So I have heard Chairman Mao on Tiananmen Square saying about the same thing. And later on, Deng Xiaoping, there's a continuity of a political dictatorship of the party, even with the economic opening changes. No matter how loud the party is speaking towards the entire country, towards the world, everybody seems like celebrating, but it is a lie. Chinese Communist Party is not so much communists of today, right? Economically, they're not following any communist rules. And Chinese Communist Party today firmly built on its nationalistic, ultra-nationalistic ideology. So how does a ruling elite group ruling such a large country with a growing economy based on an ideological lie?
I mean, Yangyang, you have a mother back home. What does this anniversary mean to her?
Yes, my immediate family and my relatives and a lot of my friends are still in China. And I think it is interesting to see their reactions towards this centenary. They do feel joy and pride. And I can recognize and relate to that a lot of that is rooted in not particularly ideological reasons, but in the sense that their lives have indeed improved drastically over the past few decades. And they channel that sense of love for their country, their sense of national belonging, and their pride in China's development into an emotional response on this occasion. And I don't think that should be vilified or demonized. Chinese culture and Chinese history are so rich and they contain multitudes. And what I do hope is that the Chinese people can give more credit to themselves instead of to the party and be able to understand that the official story is never the only story while the party is increasingly imposing the singular narrative.
Professor Xiao, Yangyang mentioned those Mao-era disasters. Remind us of what China went through in that era and how it made people question communism.
It's a time of chaos and political repression and economic deprivedness to the extreme, right? Famine and the Cultural Revolution, when the whole country lost social trust and educational system, science, technology, everything. So based on that complete disaster, the Deng Xiaoping's reverse of Mao's track and saving China going off the cliff. The openingness in the 80s was certainly a right direction to go. Even after the Tiananmen massacre, the political repression crackdown, but in the 90s, China continued the direction of economic opening up, but this time combined with a very firm party dictatorship, and that hasn't been really waiting until today, right? But the relentless, determined, and unforgiveness of the Chinese Communist Party to holding on power is getting just stronger and stronger and more sophisticated. In this digital age, China actually can deploy targeted, seamless digital control through the technology, steering any conflict pro-mass society down to the well-defined political path. And that's what you're looking at in China today. Everybody holding a smartphone, everybody on the WeChat, all their data are being amassed by the state or state-controlled corporations. And that form of social control is giving a new, not only legitimacy and surveillance, and also the power to manipulate, control the society at an absolutely new level.
And there are a lot of Chinese who recognize that. Xiao, as someone who analyzes social media conversations in China and government-run media messaging and censorship rules, what are you hearing these days about the Chinese Communist Party? And how much of the devotion that you hear is real? And where are you seeing cracks in loyalty?
Most of the online social media today is not real. It's party-constructed propaganda, digital conditioning, and, for example, all the leading entertainment figures, movie stars or singers who has large followers, popular social media accounts, are being, I'm not going to say forced, but they may self-selected for political safety, that retweeting the party propaganda right now. The party did one thing right, which is reverse the Mao's absolute disaster and giving Chinese people more economic and social freedom. A party still did things completely wrong by not letting the people participate in decisions which affecting their own lives, not let the Chinese people to have the political rights they totally deserve, and a party that's completely wrong by claiming they are the only selected non-dispute group that ruling the power, nobody else can touch it. And that is the dangerous threat to today's world order, not only sad news to the Chinese people.
One example is, for example, today on Weibo, which is kind of like the Chinese version of Twitter, and they are saying that the trending word is not Marx as in Karl Marx, but Musk as in Elon Musk. So as Professor Xiao also mentioned, that the Chinese Communist Party, of course, it is communist in name, and it's a very useful rhetoric in order to contrast itself against Western forms of governance. But it is really, in a lot of ways, capitalist on steroids. And the reason Elon Musk was trending was because he retweeted Xinhua Chinese state media in saying that how China has really developed so well and has great infrastructure and people should go China to visit.
Yang, what might be happening now that we're not noticing that could set the course for how China moves forward under the Communist Party? What are you seeing?
I do worry that I see the country, but also the people, because they can be manipulated, that it is moving in a much more militaristic, nationalistic direction. On the other hand, I am an optimist in the sense that I believe strongly in what, like Marian Kaba said, hope is a discipline. And I do have hope for the future of China and the Chinese people. And in terms of there are these cracks where we see in social activism for women's rights, for queer rights, on some of the labor organizing, that the state is imposing an extremely high cost. But a lot of young Chinese people are still trying and are still making the effort. And I think it is very important to understand that even in the most controlled environments, the control is not absolute. And it is important to recognize these multitudes. It's important to understand the nuance and to continue to help preserve this space.
Yang Cheng is a physicist, a fellow at Yale Law School, and a columnist at SubChina. Xiao Cheng is the editor of China Digital Times. He also teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and directs the school's Counterpower Lab. Thank you both very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on the show, how to design a city to ease the effect of heat waves. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Things are starting to cool off in the Pacific Northwest. The past week has been brutal. Hundreds of heat-related deaths were reported across Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. In British Columbia's biggest city, Vancouver, they saw the mercury top 100. But not everyone there felt the heat the same way. Anas Kanudbi has mapped the hot spots in Vancouver and learned how extreme heat impacts people depending on where they live in the city. Anas teaches at the University of Ottawa and joins us now. So you're no stranger to Vancouver because you've lived there, Anas. Tell us about heat mapping. What makes one part of the city warmer than another?
First of all, if you are close to the ocean, you get the sea breeze. The ocean tends to keep things nice and cool. Secondly, of course, we have the mountains in the north of Vancouver. So if you are at elevation, it obviously is cooler. And thirdly, if you're in an area that has a lot of vegetation, trees catch the sun's rays and essentially reflect some of the heat back up. Yeah, so those three are the main factors that determine how hot any part of the city gets.
And if you map it out?
Yeah, so if you map it out, you can see that there are parts of Vancouver that get really hot. And typically, East Vancouver gets pretty hot. And then as we move further inland, it gets even hotter.
So how big can those temperature differences from one neighborhood be to the next? What have you witnessed?
The temperatures that we mapped, they're the maximum air temperatures that you get on a given day, specifically on a given hot day in the summer. So like the days we've just seen in the past week. We see a difference of about 18 degrees from the hottest to the coolest places.
And that's pretty significant. What makes a difference in who lives in neighborhoods near the water and higher altitudes and who lives in those hotter parts, like in East Vancouver you're talking about?
I mean, it'll probably come as no surprise that the most expensive areas are those that have lovely views and are nice and cool and are close to the mountains and are close to the ocean. You know, everybody wants to live there. So we do see a tendency where the poorest people, they tend to live in the hottest parts of town. It's a correlation that exists. We see this with vegetation cover as well. So we see rich people, they live typically in areas that are nice and green, close to the water, and a little bit at elevation in a city like Vancouver.
So we've seen that heat has contributed, we believe, to the unexpected deaths of 65 people in Vancouver since Friday. What did your research tell you about the likelihood of heat-related deaths in different parts of the city?
Yeah, so one thing we looked at was the influence of different risk factors in translating extreme heat into mortality. And there's a lot of different factors. You know, if you are elderly, if you are poor, poorly educated, if you are socially isolated, if you live on the top floor of an apartment building and you don't have AC, those are all risk factors. So one thing we were interested in was to look at whether living in a hot part of the city was also a risk factor. And if it is, what magnitude it has compared to these other well-known risk factors. And what we found was that it is, in fact, a risk factor. It's a statistically significant risk factor. You are more likely to die during extreme heat if you live in a hot part of town. It is a small risk factor, but it is a non-negligible one.
I mean, what you're doing with heat maps is really interesting. A map tells a story. What is the heat map currently telling you?
You know, I think one thing the heat map is telling us is just how great the difference is between the temperatures that can be reached in one part of the city and in another part of the city. This is the difference between being comfortable and cool and being swelteringly hot. And so I think in the longer term, we can plan for investing most heavily in infrastructure that is designed either to cool down the city or to deal with the heat for those parts of the city that we know get the hottest and tends to have the most vulnerable population.
Anas Kanudbi is an associate professor at the University of Ottawa, speaking with us about why some parts of Vancouver have suffered more than others in this week's record-breaking heat. Thanks very much for being with us, Anas.
You're very welcome.
Let's head south now to a place that has made a huge investment in combating urban heat. Ahmedabad, India's fifth biggest city, saw a devastating heat wave in 2010 that killed more than 1,000 people. Since then, it's come up with a heat action plan that's seen as a model across South Asia. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The World's Anna Kusmer has been speaking with people in Ahmedabad in northwest India about their approach to keeping people safe in the heat. Anna, what have they done that's worked out so well?
Ahmedabad came up with the first really comprehensive heat plan in all of South Asia, which is a global hotspot for extreme heat. I talked to Dilip Mavalankar, who heads the city's Institute of Public Health. He's one of the people that built this plan. And he says there are four major components, short-term solutions and longer-term ones.
First is public awareness.
that heat can kill.
A couple years after that 2010 horrible heat wave, the city launched this big public health campaign. For example, sending leaflets home with kids from school to educate them and their parents about extreme heat. They put PSAs out on the radio, TV, social media. They also created this color-coded warning system for heat and a system for alerting hospitals when it's coming. And then after that awareness phase comes action.
How to develop adaptation and resilience among the community. So once you alert the community, what do they do?
The plan next gives people something to do during those really hot days. Things like installed cooling centers and water stations so people could stay hydrated. They set up shelters at night for people to sleep in. They also increased access to green spaces.
So raising awareness, there are changes to help people cool down day to day. That's the short term. What is the longer term work you were talking about?
These are bigger changes to the city that cool it sort of in the long term, but it takes time to implement these things. One example is an effort to paint roofs. So in slums, particularly, people have these metal roofs that absorb a ton of heat. Part of the plan is this program to paint the roofs white so they reflect instead of absorb the sun's rays. Mavalan Kar says another big strategy is more trees.
The last long-term measures were greening of the city. So city itself tries to plant as many trees as possible.
More green cover reflects the sun, it creates shade, and the city is also increasing what's known as blue spaces near water. Like there's this big ongoing riverfront park development that's been going on for years.
So green spaces, blue spaces, what's been the overall effect of all these changes, Anna?
The changes seem to have worked. A study from 2 years ago found that the plan, on average, saves around 1,100 lives a year. But climate change is expected to make India and the whole region a lot hotter. And also, Ahmedabad, like a lot of cities in the world, is rapidly urbanizing. And that makes it hard to preserve and expand green space. It's a big struggle for Mavalan Kar and city planners.
And this kind of plan, this model that Ahmedabad has, it's gaining traction around South Asia?
Yes. Palash Mukherjee is based in Delhi with the Natural Resources Defense Council, who has helped with this plan. And he says Ahmedabad's success inspired a lot of other plans.
As of 2021, there are more than 100 cities across 23 states in India that have similar heat action plans. All that began with Ahmedabad.
Wow. Anna, what do you see as a takeaway for the rest of the world?
When I asked Mukherjee that question, what he thought the special sauce of Ahmedabad's plan was, why it saved so many lives, he said there were two things. One, the plan was really community-driven. It worked with people to understand what they needed. Two, the plan really focused on the most vulnerable people.
There are a lot of outdoor workers, including, you know, migrant laborers, construction workers, street side vendors, who were specifically targeted by this plan.
Prioritizing the most vulnerable people from extreme heat helped save the most lives.
The world's Anna Kusmer, thanks very much for telling us about this heat mitigation scheme in India.
Thanks, Marco. Stay cool.
We'll be right back with more in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. Since the January 6th Capitol attacks, the Biden White House has turned its focus inward on domestic terrorism. For many Muslim Americans, it's worrisome. They know what surveillance feels like.
From the moment that we would pick up the receiver actually on our landline, it would start recording.
And worry about being mistaken for targets again. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Protesters in Turkey today shouting, the world will turn upside down if women don't have freedom. Some of the freedom is being stripped away. Today, Turkey formally ended its participation in a European treaty to prevent violence against women. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's conservative government is defending the decision. He claims that the document's protections for LGBT people go against Turkish family values. Duri Buscaran reports from Istanbul.
To feminist journalist Burcu Karakoş, leaving the Istanbul Convention is about control.
The convention is something that empowers women. When women feel much more powerful, they find the courage in themselves so they can just divorce their husbands.
Protections in the Istanbul Convention, Karakaş says, have helped Turkish women leave abusive relationships, file for divorce, and this has led to a backlash in the conservative government.
The government sees the family union as something sacred, and it should be protected from all dangers.
Women's rights activists in Turkey say the country is rife with intimate partner violence that goes unpunished. They've documented 189 killings of women since the beginning of the year, many of them by boyfriends, former partners, or family members. The Istanbul Convention was originally opened for signature in Istanbul. That's where it got its name. But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's conservative government announced this spring that it would withdraw from the convention on July 1st. A lawsuit saying the decision to withdraw should have gone through Turkey's parliament was rejected in court.
Kadına yönelik şiddetle mücadele 4. Ulusal Eylem Planı'nın
earlier today, President Erdogan said his government would commit to a local plan to prevent violence against women, saying the main purpose would be changing society's perspective on violence by raising awareness.
Annemizin, eşimizin,
the fight against violence against women is also the struggle to protect the rights, law, and honor of our mothers, wives, and daughters, each of whom is a part of our lives, he says. The Turkish government's rationale for exiting the Istanbul Convention, that it normalizes homosexuality, is part of what activists say is a growing effort on the part of the government to marginalize the LGBT community. Yıldız Tar of KaosJL, an Ankara-based rights platform, says government officials and loyalist media are repeating these messages.
61% of the articles and news were directly targeting LGBTI people, containing hate speech, and there were discriminatory language.
Even the head of Turkey's Directorate of Religious Affairs claimed in a Ramadan sermon that homosexuality was to blame for the COVID pandemic. And in some cases, these words translate to very real violence. Tar says hate crimes against the LGBT community are up in Turkey.
Most of the hate crimes were happening in the public places. There were eyewitnesses. Half of them remained silent. A quarter of them joined the attackers.
To Tar, the fact that these attacks happen in public shows a greater impunity on the part of the perpetrators. In June, pride events were banned by local authorities, but 22-year-old Lizge Biter had tried to attend a small march in a liberal neighborhood. The group was tear-gassed and 25 people were arrested. Afterwards, she sat down on some steps in a park with her friends in defeat.
The government is actually began to attack more than usual.
As recently as 2014, tens of thousands of people attended a pride march down Istanbul's largest pedestrian thoroughfare, the largest in the Muslim world. Today, that feels like a distant reality.
Actually, it was always unsafe, but in today's, it's become more civil, I think.
Today, she says, things are clear. Women and the LGBT community have a long way to go before they feel safe in Turkey. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
When applying for a passport in the U.S., you check a box, M for male or F for female. If you want to change the gender on your passport, you need medical certification. You used to, anyway. The State Department announced yesterday that Americans will now be allowed to self-select their gender marker. No certification needed. The department will also soon add a third gender option for Americans who identify as non-binary, intersex, or gender non-conforming. A number of countries already do this: Argentina, Canada, Denmark, and Nepal, to name just a few. In the announcement, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the move is to ensure the fair treatment of LGBTQI+ U.S. citizens, though the department noted that because of the complexities of updating their IT systems, it may take some time before Americans can actually choose male, female, or a third option. U.S. troops still have more than 2 months before their withdrawal from Afghanistan is complete. The European troops from the NATO forces there are ahead of that timeline. Yesterday, Germany said that its mission in Afghanistan has officially ended. Joining us from Berlin is Christian Möhling. He heads the Security and Defense Program at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Christian, take us back to how the German mission in Afghanistan actually began. What drew Germany into Afghanistan in the first place?
Basically was the will to show solidarity with the US. And that was a very clear and initial decision by, at that time, Chancellor Schröder, who said, of course, we will stand with our allies, taking also into account that he has taken a hard stance on the US before and afterwards. But that was a pretty clear situation. If this is an Article 5, we are going to be with you in Afghanistan. Interestingly, although Germany always has hard feelings about military action, there was always a majority in parliament to support this operation until the very end.
So now that the German mission in Afghanistan is officially over, what are your big takeaways?
The big takeaway is, especially if we take a look into the domestic debate in Germany, there was a very serious discussion all the time over the last 20 years with regard to this mission. There was always support for this mission. And I had the impression, also the feeling, that it was right to do so on the one hand, to stand side by side with our allies, but also right to do so to give Afghanistan and the people living there an opportunity to possibly go into a better life and have a better time after the Taliban's.
Well, let's unpack that piece by piece, because there was a recent ceremony dedicated to the end of the German mission in Afghanistan, and Brigadier General Ansgar Meyer, the last commander of the German contingent there, said to his troops, quote, "As your commander, I can say for you, mission accomplished. You fulfilled your task." How would you respond to that assessment?
I think that's technically correct. It still has a strange taste in Germany, because many remember the mission accomplished photograph taken from Mr. Bush on an aircraft carrier.
Regarding the Iraq war.
On the Iraq war, exactly. This picture speaks so much about how the Germans view the Americans, and especially military engagement, because this photo had a very negative taste here in Germany. So from that point of view, I would say on the political sphere, people would say, no, the mission is not accomplished, and we would be very critical about such missions in the future. But for the military, I would say they just have to get all the honor for serving in this very difficult environment and standing and also fighting and dying for the will of our people here and of our parliament.
Fair enough. I mean, looking forward, the security experts are worried that the situation in Afghanistan is not stable and military assistance is still needed. Major concerns the country could fall into a civil war, or the Taliban will simply strong arm their way to power. Do you think it's smart for U.S. troops and NATO troops to withdraw from Afghanistan right now?
I think if the political will is no longer there, I think then there is no longer any political legitimacy for it. So you can't sustain an operation. The same is true for Germany. I guess what we have to take into account is we have started this mission at a time when interventionism was at a high time. We thought, as the West, which was at that time kind of still the West, we could change the world by military intervention as a force for good. And we had a rather steep learning curve over the last 20 years, how little we can achieve through military intervention, even if they are accompanied by political and stabilization efforts, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, I guess that for all the other missions, even the Americans are not keen on taking on such risky operations again with such a large contingency.
The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq remain a really big part of the American conscience. Many here know it's not going to be easy to just walk away from these so-called forever wars. For Germans, what will the legacy be of the mission in Afghanistan?
The legacy is a mixed one. I mean, this war, interestingly, has very early been a forgotten war. So people have not forgotten it, but wanted to forget about it, because it was so far away and it was always difficult to explain to the people why we are there and what we are doing there and why this is worth the effort. I can only hope that the people take home that we have presented an effort as part of the international community. You can never, if you walk into a war, know what is the outcome of this. If we are realistic, and if you ask in 1 year time the German people about German contribution to Afghanistan and the military mission over there, most of the people will have forgotten about it.
Christian Mörling heads the Security and Defense Program at the German Council on Foreign Relations think tank, speaking with us about the end of the German military mission in Afghanistan. Christian, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
The name Donald Rumsfeld can provoke strong feelings. The death of the former Secretary of Defense on Tuesday at the age of 88 is a chance to ponder his legacy. Writer and journalist James Fallows followed Rumsfeld's career over the decades and interviewed him several times, starting in the early 1980s. He joins us from Washington. Jim, many critics of Donald Rumsfeld might say his legacy begins and ends with the Iraq War. Regardless of the legacy timeline, he had quite a career. Can you describe the arc of it? When people live into old age, it's hard to imagine they were ever young and shiny, and Donald Rumsfeld certainly was that. He went to Princeton. He was captain of the wrestling team there. He was a naval aviator and flight instructor. He was elected to Congress at age 30. He was sort of the model of what we now think of as an almost extinct version of Republican, of the Midwestern, commonsensical, handsome in the madman fashion. He voted for the Civil Rights Act of 1965 when he was in Congress. And then again, as a young man, he took administrative positions in the Nixon and Ford administration. So if the judgment had been made when Donald Rumsfeld was around age 45 or 50, people would have thought a promising, precocious, moderate career.
So here's Donald Rumsfeld in 2006. This is 3 years into the Iraq War. It's a recorded message he gave to U.S. forces after he was forced to retire. It's about the war on terror.
The long struggle we are in is complex, it's unfamiliar, and it's still little understood, leading some to believe that there is no need to go on.
So, Jim Fallows, the war in Iraq. To what degree is Donald Rumsfeld responsible for the U.S. decision to invade Iraq in 2003?
He was relatively under-involved in the decision to go to war, to use the 9/11 attacks as the justification for invading Iraq itself. Dick Cheney was much more centrally involved in that, Paul Wolfowitz and some others. But it was when the planning for the war began and its execution that Rumsfeld himself came much more into center stage.
To your knowledge, did he ever feel regret about what happened in Iraq or take any responsibility?
It's worth being clear about what it is that Rumsfeld should take responsibility for, or might feel culpable, which was essentially he refused to prepare for what it would mean to hold the territory that the U.S. forces could take relatively quickly in the spring of 2003. Rumsfeld believed in a concept of lightweight precision military operations. He kept lowballing the figures for what it would take in terms of troop presence to hold Iraq. And in his public and private life, both in the following years as Secretary of Defense and then as a private citizen, he was notably unreflective, unrepentant, quite a contrast to Robert McNamara, who spent the rest of his life after Secretary of Defense and during the Vietnam War essentially bearing the burden of those decisions.
In Rumsfeld's memoir, I mean, despite the massive casualties in Iraq, he essentially seemed to say that the war went over time and over budget. Did he ever express any regrets about the death toll?
Not that I would am aware. And this seems to be in the nature of the man, that he had been so successful so early with this jaunty, straight-ahead approach. And it's worth mentioning that after serving as the youngest Secretary of Defense in U.S. history under Gerald Ford, he went on to become a very successful business CEO and made a lot of money that way. And everything in his life had prepared him for the idea that quick decisions, snap judgments, look forward rather than back. I'm not aware that he ever talked about the hundreds of thousands of lives that were lost in Iraq and around the world and the United States because of the way he had planned the war.
It seems like everyone who knew Rumsfeld, friend or foe, describe him as driven, tireless, smart, politically cunning. As someone who interviewed him several times, Jim, how did he come across?
He was somebody who prided himself on quick repartee-like responses to questions. He viewed interviews almost as debates. Rumsfeld enjoyed this sort of fencing, parry, and thrust of discussions. You don't really mean that. You can't say that. Well, what do you mean? Okay, well, I did say that. And so back and forth. Again, he enjoyed the quickness, I think, as opposed to the depth. So he was interesting to talk with, but I think it showed, again, the strengths and perhaps the limitations of his executive functions.
That's fascinating. Jim, what do you think is Rumsfeld's legacy?
Sadly, it has to be the management and mismanagement of the Iraq War. He was the exemplar of a mid-century moderate Republicanism when he rose in politics. He ran the Office of Economic Opportunity during the Nixon and Ford years and was an ambassador to NATO. But sadly, he went back perhaps when he should not have and made a very destructive decision, even worse in its consequences.
James Fallows is a writer, journalist, and correspondent for The Atlantic who interviewed and wrote about Donald Rumsfeld throughout his long career in public service. Jim, thank you very much.
Marco, my pleasure. Thank you.
The impact of U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is a story that we continue following, a story that continues to develop as we near the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Visit theworld.org to read and listen to our coverage of the so-called Forever Wars. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter, emailed to you each morning. That's all at theworld.org. Fans of the Tour de France watched in horror on Saturday as a massive crash derailed the first stage at the mother of all cycling races.
They've gone under that banner.
Oh!
Oh, the massive crash there. What has happened? Right on the side of the road there. Look at this.
Spectator inadvertently caused the crash, as we reported earlier this week. She was holding up a cardboard sign, leaning into the road, facing the TV cameras, not the oncoming riders. So she didn't see German cyclist Tony Martin barreling toward her. Martin took a nasty fall, triggering a big pileup. Several riders were injured, one withdrew from the race, and the woman holding the sign fled the scene. Not an ideal start to the race, to say the least. Tour de France organizers said they were going to find the woman, then take legal action. So other overzealous spectators understand not to spoil the show for everyone. Yesterday, French police said they arrested the suspect. The woman's name has not been released, but she's being identified as a 30-year-old French woman. Today, organizers of the Tour say they are not going to sue. Race director Christian Prudhomme said, "We'd like to calm things down. The message has got across that the roadside fans need to be careful." For the fan holding the sign, it's not over, though. She could still face legal action from the riders themselves. It's been nearly 6 months since the U.S. Capitol was breached. Just yesterday, the House of Representatives voted, mostly along party lines, to create a select committee to investigate the January 6 attack. Two Republicans joined 220 Democrats to create the panel. The storming of the Capitol also pushed the Biden administration to create a national strategy to combat domestic extremism. The move has been praised but also criticized. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, many worry that the strategy could lead to targeting of Muslim Americans and people of color.
After the September 11th attacks, the U.S. government began to surveil and infiltrate Muslim American communities to find people planning more violence. One they identified was Palestinian Sami Al-Aryan, a Florida professor. He was arrested in 2003 for having ties to a U.S.-designated terrorist group. A jury failed to convict, and he was later deported. His daughter, Lina Al-Aryan, remembers their family being surveilled for years. She recently spoke at an online discussion about surveillance.
From the moment that we would pick up the receiver, actually on our landline, it would start recording. And we're a house full of people and five kids. Some of the time the phone would be knocked off the wall and it would just be off the hook for a while. And it would be recording everything that was going on in the house.
That kind of surveillance happened across the country. In 2008, Muslim Americans in Southern California told law enforcement about suspicious new mosque members promoting violence. They turned out to be FBI informants. Three Muslim Americans sued, attempting to get the FBI to share the information it had gathered to prove that they were targeted because of their religion. That battle is ongoing. Just last month, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to weigh in on the case. Amer Shabaik is the managing civil rights attorney at the Council on American-Islamic Relations in L.A.
These actions, this surveillance and the spying wasn't based on any sort of suspicion of criminal activity or anything like that. It was really simply for the fact that these individuals were Muslim.
The surveillance and infiltration were part of a larger strategy that at one point was called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. The basic idea is to recruit community leaders, social workers, teachers, and public health providers to help identify people who might commit terrorism. CVE's many critics said it was a way for the government to target and harass marginalized communities. But the strategy evolved, says Javed Ali, who held senior counterterrorism positions at the Department of Homeland Security and FBI.
There were cases in the 2010s where the Bureau, having opened up some kind of investigation on someone who potentially could have either been radicalized, and instead of just arresting that person, they actually thought about off-ramps to arrest and perhaps getting those persons help that they needed.
Still, some officials regret aspects of CVE. John Cohen works on threat prevention at DHS. He spoke in June at George Washington University.
I have to say, and I've been saying this publicly, and I know it's going to raise some eyebrows, is
that while there were great intentions, some of the assumptions we based that approach on were flawed. CVE was based on the approach that individuals who were high risk were coming from specific religious and ethnic communities. That's one of the things we found to be not true.
Despite that, the Biden administration's new plan to combat domestic extremism includes a version of CVE, like working with social service organizations and mental health and education professionals to identify potential terrorists. This year, the Biden administration is giving $77 million to state and local governments to combat domestic extremism, and it wants to up that to $131 million next year. Cohen says this time they've made a crucial change. Instead of focusing on people of a particular religion or ethnicity, they'll look for people with certain behavioral characteristics.
What we're doing now is very different. We're leveraging what is more like a public health approach, where we understand that there are behavioral characteristics, there are social characteristics, there are individual characteristics of individuals that make them more vulnerable to being influenced by extremist content that they're seeing online, make them a higher risk of using violence as a way to express their anger.
But the government's own studies have found that it's really tough to narrow down the characteristics of people who might commit terrorism, says Harsha Pandurangan. He's with the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program in New York.
A lot of the conditions that I've identified, whether it's being socially alienated, having a grievance, being depressed, having mental health issues, these are conditions that millions of Americans experience.
He says leaving things broad and vague like that gives local law enforcement wide latitude.
I think that the degree that the potential flagging of people as those who could turn violent is so open-ended, that's inevitably going to lead to bias seeping into the process. And we know who's typically affected by that.
So as the Biden administration goes forward with its plan to combat domestic extremism, Muslim Americans like Lina Al-Aryan, whose family was surveilled for years, now find themselves in the unlikely position of defending white extremists who may fall under suspicion.
Although we don't like their views, they may not necessarily have ever carried out the plot that the government concocted.
She argues that in the U.S., even people suspected of extremism should be treated fairly. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Finally today, the Biden administration said it would donate 80 million coronavirus vaccines by the end of June to countries that need them. Well, June has come and gone. Today, though, we got this update from Jeff Zients. He's the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator.
These 80 million doses have all been shared with 46 countries, the African Union, and CARICOM.
CARICOM includes Caribbean countries, but there's a catch to the U.S. donations. Half of them have not yet arrived at their destinations. Zients said they're on their way.
By the end of this week, we will have shipped out about 40 million doses, including doses to the Republic of Korea, Mexico, Canada, Brazil, Taiwan, Honduras, Colombia, Pakistan, Peru, Ecuador, Malaysia, and Bangladesh.
Zients also said the U.S. plans to contribute tens of millions more doses in coming months. Dr. Krishna Udayakumar with Duke's Global Health Institute says these American donations are a good start, but
we're not moving fast enough to share doses, and we have massively underestimated the investment and work required for distribution and delivery of vaccines.
There's transportation logistics, quality control challenges, and international legal issues that need to be worked out. Udayakumar says these processes have to be streamlined. The task is urgent as the highly contagious Delta variant rips across the planet. And with that, we close things down for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow with more stories from across the globe.